books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we're talking to JP Rose about her Carnegie shortlisted book, Birdie, and her alter ego, Jackie Rose, about gangland thrillers and collaborating with Martina Cole. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. The next book we'll feature on the Carnegie shortlist is Birdie by JP Rose, who, under the name Jackie Rose, also writes some adult gangland fiction, which we'll hear about later. I've been holding off playing this interview, as although the audiobook is being recorded, it's not yet in the RNIB library. But it's on the way. Birdie is a middle-grade historical fiction set in the 1950s Yorkshire Dales. A heartwarming story that follows Birdie and her experiences with friendships, adoption, and animals. When Birdie is sent to live with her great-aunt in 1950s Yorkshire, she befriends the village's last remaining pit pony. A story of hope and courage, which carefully and sensitively handles themes of racism, family, and identity. Here's the author, J.P. Rose.
Birdie is set in 1952 in Yorkshire, one of my favourite places. And it's about a little girl who has been brought up in a children's home for what the press called homes for brown babies. And what it is that the children's homes were for children who had been born of American, Black American GIs and white British women. And what the government decided to do was separate these children from the white children. So they had these special homes and the press coined them homes for brown babies. So that's the fact behind Birdie, where we start and we find her in this happy home for children. And the thing about it is she's always wanted to have a family of her very own, even though she's actually very happy in this children's home. And one day, a letter comes, and it's from her great-aunt Mabel. And her great-aunt Mabel has only discovered that she exists and said, you know, we would love Birdie to come and live with us in this little village of Barrington Dale. So Birdie is excited, a bit nervous and apprehensive. She's leaving behind everything she knows. And she goes to this tiny village in the Yorkshire Dales. She's very excited because she's heard all about having a family of her own. When she knocks on the door, her great aunt Mabel is very shocked to see her, because her great aunt Mabel actually has no idea what Birdie looked like. So her great aunt Mabel straight away is asking her to call, you know, her Mrs. Winterbottom by her name. Don't call me great aunt Mabel, because she actually doesn't want anybody in the village to know that she's got a great niece who is a child of colour. And that's really where it starts for Birdie, and trying to navigate this village, navigate this family who don't necessarily accept her. But at the same time, her great aunt is going through a huge change because she's lost her son in the Second World War. And just like the country was going through a huge change, everybody in the villages, and the pit in the village is closing down. And that really is the centre of the village. And there's the one last remaining pit pony that Birdie connects with and befriends. And it's from that moment onwards that Birdie's life starts to change forever in this little village.
When you were grown up, you were allowed to ride a scruffy wee cob called Wild Son. Did Wild Son become the pit pony in the book, Mr. Duke?
Well, what it was is that I had a real love for ponies because I didn't have loads of friends growing up. So I had that connection, like Birdie has the connection in the book with a pony. But actually what it was, I wanted to pay homage and wanted to champion the pit ponies I used to see when I was growing up, because they really were the unsung heroes of the coal industry. And like war horse. I really wanted to champion their lives. I wanted to talk about what they had to go through, and I didn't want them to be forgotten, because a lot of children in classrooms these days actually don't learn about pit ponies. And it's really interesting when I go around schools, when I say, does everybody know what a pit pony does? Does everybody know what a pit pony is? And a lot of children don't. So I'm really pleased that I was able to cement what they did for this country in the Book of Birdie.
Are those children quite shocked when you tell them about pit ponies?
Absolutely. They really are shocked, because the idea, because they see horses and ponies in the fields, in stables, running, free. And the idea that these pit ponies were taken down into the pit, probably from the age of about 2 years old, and that was their life forever. Often a lot of them didn't go up to see the light again. There were some that did go up daily, back and forth, back and forth, but the majority of them slept there, worked there, and died there. And the idea for children that these pit ponies, thousands upon thousands, because in sort of the 1950s, 1940s, we had 70,000 pit ponies living underground. It's really quite shocking to them. And it was a really tough life for the pit ponies, because the miners used to be paid on the amount of coal they used to bring up to the surface. So obviously they're going to push their pit pony faster and harder, even though the pit pony may have been exhausted and may even be injured, because it was dangerous working underground. And so these pit ponies used to work 14, 15, 16 hours a day, bringing up the coal to the lift shafts, and then just sleeping in the dark. It was a very, very difficult life for them. So yes, children are absolutely shocked, and I've got the records and diaries that I read out to the children of miners who had written, diary excerpts about the pit ponies, so they can really see and hear how it feels, how m it must have felt for miners working alongside pit ponies. So it's really fascinating.
And expanding on that a wee bit, it must be hard to convey to the children just how wounded the whole country was in the 50s after the war.
Absolutely, because it's that sort of period of time that they don't really learn about, because it's, obviously they learn about World War II, and then it sort of jumps. But absolutely, everywhere you look, there was such a massive change in the country, emotional change, industrial change, rebuilding the country. Absolutely, the whole country was wounded in one way or the other, and really difficult. And that sense of belonging and identity, not only for Birdie, is rippled through the whole book, in the sense that it's a mirror to the country. The idea of this enormous change, what's happening, who are we as a country, what does that look like, what does that look like when we're suffering en masse grief for our, people that we've lost.
Did you give Birdie an age?
It's interesting, because I didn't specifically say how old she was in the book, because in a way she feels slightly ageless. So if I have to be sort of pinned down to it, she would be anywhere between the age of 10 and 12. But I felt like maybe 12 was slightly too old, and maybe, sort of 10 was the perfect age. But I didn't actually necessarily want to say she's 10 years old. I just wanted the reader to picture her, because she's such a life force. I thought it was really important for the reader to see her and imagine her for, what their imaginations take her down which road.
Is it kind of the book, or rather, is it kind of the character you wanted to read when you were that age?
Absolutely. I would have loved to read a book about Birdie, to be really connected to the book and to proverbially see myself on the page, because when I was young, there weren't the books, there weren't the books, that I could identify with. And that's really important for everybody, to be able to connect and relate to some of the characters within the books. And there's so many characters, so many people that are sort of not seen amongst the pages of the book, that it's really important to give them a voice. So I'm really passionate about inclusivity, whatever that looks like, definitely inclusive. So yes, I would have loved to have got, oh, there's a child that I can relate to. There's a child that's going through what I'm going through, because I wasn't brought up with my birth parents, neither was Birdie. And I would have loved to be able to relate to that, because otherwise it feels like maybe you're invisible if people don't write about your stories and your voices aren't heard, and it's so important.
Now, you're writing this book under the name J.P. Rose, but people may be familiar with you as Jackie Rose. What was the jump between sort of crime and gangland books to children's books?
Well, I'd always actually wanted to write children's books from the beginning. So I went into writing, wanted to write stories for young people, because as I say, it was really something I had such a passion for, because I hadn't seen myself within the pages. So I wanted to make sure that I could write all sorts of stories and be really inclusive in my stories. But when I started writing, this was about 12 years ago, sort of really serious about it, sending off to agents and, hoping to get published, it wasn't as diverse storytelling as it is now. And so when I sent my book off to an agent, they went, well, you can clearly write, but I don't think the publishing industry is really ready for this sort of book that you're writing. And it was, again, it was a quirky book like Birdie, but for maybe for slightly older teenagers. And they said, but if you could write adult, that would be fantastic. And HarperCollins, that right now I know for a fact, are looking for somebody to write gangland books, because one of their gangland authors had moved to another publisher. Would you be interested? And I didn't know anything about the publishing industry. And so I said, yeah, of course. And they said, well, you've got 6 weeks to write it. So I was like, okay. And I thought that was normal. I thought 6 weeks was a normal time frame, whereas now I know it's like 6 months. So that's how I really got into it. So I started to write gangland. I wrote the first book, Taken, which is set in Soho, and from there it became a bestseller and became popular. And then I just sort of start just continued writing in that sort of same genre, because I had a bit of imposter syndrome, and I just thought, if I branched out, maybe people wouldn't want to read their books, maybe the agent's right that maybe the publishing industry isn't ready for my children's books. But after I had written so many, because I think I've written about 20 adult books now, but my adoptive mum passed away, and I really struggled with grief. I really struggled to know where to put those feelings. And I thought, well, if I'm struggling, how does a young person feel? So as I had always done, because I had always written for pleasure and put my emotions and my feelings and my worries down on the page, I wrote The Haunting of Tyrese Walker about a young boy who had lost his father. So that was very cathartic for me, but that was the start of my journey into writing children's books, because it was sold to a publisher, and then it did quite well. It won some awards. It's studied in some schools. So then from there, I wrote Birdie. But that's how really I started sort of wanting to start with children, but then jumping to crime because somebody suggested it, and then back to my passion of writing for children.
And we'll have more from J.P. Rose after we take a visit to RNIB Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Judy, A Dog in a Million, From Runaway Pup to the World's Most Heroic Dog by Damien Lewis, was given to us by Quercus.
Only one animal ever achieved the dubious accolade of being made an official prisoner of war of the Japanese in World War II. It was a dog. She was a beautiful and regal-looking English pointer, and perhaps one of the most extraordinary of our canine companions ever to grace this earth. In September 1942, she was given Japanese prisoner of war number 81A, Medan. Her real name was Judy, or Judy of Sussex, as her shipmates came to call her, for she spent most of her service life as the mascot of the Royal Navy gunboats, the Gnat, and the Grasshopper. But Judy of Sussex was much, much, much more than just a ship's dog. The way in which I came across her story drew me to it, inexorably, convincing me that this was a tale that absolutely had to be told. In the spring of 2013, I wrote a book called War Dog, although I prefer the title my American publishers gave it, The Dog Who Could Fly. It tells the story of Ant, the extraordinary German shepherd puppy rescued from no man's land, who went on to fly numerous sorties with the RAF in the Second World War. In recognition of his heroic wartime exploits, Ant, or Antis, as he was renamed, was awarded the Dickin Medal, more commonly known as the Animal VC.
Judy, a beautiful liver and white English pointer, was the only animal POW of World War II. She was truly a dog in a million, cherished and adored by British, Australian, American and other Allied servicemen who fought to survive alongside her. Viewed largely as human by those who exterred her extraordinary life, Judy's uncanny ability to sense danger, matched with her quick thinking and impossible daring, saved countless lives. She was a close companion to men who became like a family to her, sharing in both the tragedies and joys they faced. It was in recognition of the extraordinary friendship and protection she offered amidst the unforgiving and savage environment of a Japanese prison camp in Indonesia that she gained her formal status as a POW. Judy's unique combination of courage, kindness and fun repaid that honour 1,000 times over, and her incredible story is one of the most heartwarming and inspiring tales you will ever hear.
Ant's master was the Czech, later British, Airman Robert Bosdich, with whom he flew into battle with RAF Bomber Command, was wounded, crash-landed and faced death countless times. In among the photos of the post-war Dickin Medal ceremonies, I found one that appeared to show Antis receiving his medal along with two other dogs. The animal to the right of the photo was a striking-looking liver and white English pointer. There was something compelling about that image and the animal it portrayed, a sense somehow of the dog's extraordinary courage and spirit that spoke across the decades. When next I met the Bosdich family, Robert Bosdich's surviving children, I showed them the photo and asked who the mystery dog might be. We were at Pip's, the eldest sister's, lovely Devon farmhouse, having a family get-together to celebrate the publication of the book telling their father and Antis's story. Pip took a look at the photo. "I think that must be Judy." "Yes, it's got to be her. Isn't she lovely? She's another Dickin Medal winner, and she has the most wonderful story."
Judy, A Dog in a Million by Damien Lewis is read by Ben Addis and runs for 10 hours and 50 minutes.
My Next Breath by Jeremy Renner was donated by Simon & Schuster.
The snowcat was sliding across the ice towards Alex. Alex is my nephew. He's 27. My sister Kim's youngest. I've always kind of had a father-son relationship with him. He's one of the first boys in the extended family, very sweet kid. The snowcat is a 14,000-pound industrial snow-clearing machine that I use on my property in the mountains north of Lake Tahoe. That machine was heading towards him. He had nowhere to escape to. His back was up against a huge Ford Raptor F-150 truck, which was itself jammed up against a snowbank. It was January 1st, 2023. I believe the most important thing in life is to take action. Feel everything, consider everything, read, think, ponder, cogitate. All that's fine. But you have to do something. You have to commit to action whenever you can. Don't only think about things. Don't just feel things. Take the first step, and then the next, and then the next. Do it. Otherwise, nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to get better for you or for the people around you. In the end, it doesn't actually matter what you think or how you feel. Everyone is a mass of feelings and emotions, some good, some bad. But emotions never build a bridge, or fed the hungry, or saved a life. I mean, who cares how you feel? Do something.
Two-time Oscar nominee Jeremy Renner was the second most Googled person in 2023, and not for his impressive filmography. Amongst other iconic roles, he captured hearts as fan-favourite comic book marksman Hawkeye in 7 Marvel films. Yet his otherworldly success on screen faded to the periphery when a £14,000 snowplow crushed him on New Year Day 2023. Somehow able to keep breathing for more than half an hour, he was subsequently rushed to the ICU, after which he would face multiple surgeries and months of painful rehabilitation. Jeremy recounts his recovery journey and reflects on the impact of his suffering. Ultimately, Jeremy's memoir is a testament to the human spirit and its capacity to endure, evolve, and find purpose in the face of unimaginable adversity. His writing captures the essence of profound transformation, exploring the delicate interplay between vulnerability and strength, despair and hope, redemption and renewal.
An immense £14,000 machine was sliding towards my nephew, and I had to do something. In those lightning-fast seconds, his life hung in the balance. If that machine was to hit him, it would have crushed him to death, no question. But this new year was going to be the same as any previous year in one crucial way. To me, action was everything. It's at the core of who I am. I do stuff. I take action. I believe in the power of a deed done. I am blessed by a large extended family whom I love more than anything. And I believe in action. These two immovable forces, love and action, were about to collide. I had no choice. I had one shot. One shot. A long shot, but a shot. Not for a second did I think about my other life, the one in which I do most of my own stunts, the Hawkeye I inhabit in movies. This man, faced with one shot, is not, at that moment, a Hollywood actor. He's just me. Jeremy Renner, uncle to Alex, father to Ava, son and a brother, an uncle, friend to many, pain in the ass to plenty. Half a mile down his driveway from his home in Lake Tahoe, where, right now, back up there at the house, folks are innocently getting ready for a ski trip after days being snowed in by a monster storm. I live for that gang up at the house. They are my whole life, my heart. I love each of them with such intensity. But here, now, I had one thing to do. I had to save Alex. One shot, one action that would change everything and come to define the second half of my life. A 3-foot leap up and a nearly 3-foot leap across to the cabin of the snowcat, where I would grab the door handle, get inside the cab, and hit the big red stop button sitting on the center of the console. The snowcat is charging towards Alex. He's got no escape route. The snowcat weighs over 14,000 pounds. He's standing by an F-150, which is itself against the snowbank. He's going to be crushed between the Ford and the thick steel blades of the snowcat. He's got nowhere to go. One shot.
My Next Breath by Jeremy Renner is read by the author and runs for 6 hours and 36 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in Braille so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And now a return to Jackie Rose. Bear in mind, we're going from children's literature to Soho ganglands, although after a bit of hunting, the clip I've found is appropriate for all listeners. Sinner by Jackie Rose is read by Annie Aldington.
Another person who seemed to have Alfie on their mind was Franny Doyle. But it was another couple of hours before she'd cleaned herself up and found herself walking slowly along the bustling streets of Soho towards their club, just off Sutton Row. Although Soho had changed a lot over the years, she still felt at home here. It gave her a certain kind of peace, like nowhere else did. She'd been raised in the small square mile of Soho, and around each and every corner were memories. Happy childhood memories, and she could almost feel the ghosts of the past. She smiled sadly to herself as she walked past St. Anne's Church on Dean Street, remembering how her father, Patrick, a number one face, had once raced her home from there to their large house in Soho Square. Him running and her pedalling away on the new pink bike he'd given her like her life depended on it. And they'd laughed hard and hysterically whilst the rain lashed down, and they'd been soaked to the skin, but it hadn't mattered. Not one little bit. Until those days had been complicated, they were happy ones, and she supposed that's what she missed most of all. The simple pleasures. The laughter. Something that was certainly absent from her life of late. Though one thing that being back had done was reconnect her with the past and take away any doubt she had. It made her see even more clearly what was important to her. And that was family. Family came in all different ways and in all different manners. Family didn't need to be about blood, but that didn't mean she wouldn't protect them like they were, no matter what it took, no matter what she had to do. So yes, even though life at the moment was difficult and stressful, and at times it felt like she wasn't coping properly, she was pleased to be here among the vibrant streets of Soho. Not that it had been her idea to come back. It had been Alfie's. Nor had it been her idea to get back into the club business. Again, that had been Alfie's. But considering the state of mind he was in, she couldn't have persuaded him otherwise, even if she'd tried.
That's Annie Aldington reading from Sinner by Jackie Rose. Now, Annie seems to be your default narrator for your adult books. Were you responsible for her casting?
Well, the first one, I wasn't. The first one, Taken, and I think Trapped, I don't think I was for the first or second, but actually I enjoyed listening to Annie because I am a fan of audiobooks. I listen to more audiobooks than I do read, and it's really important for me what the narrator sounds like. So when I heard Annie, you know, reading the books, I was blown away by her, and I could actually listen to my books without thinking, oh gosh, that's a awkward sentence. Why did I write that? I actually just enjoyed her narration. And I thought, well, you know, if I'm enjoying it, hopefully other people are. And then I looked online and people really do enjoy Annie's narration because she really brings the characters to life. She really acts them, not just reads them, that you can just feel it, and you're taken back to Soho, you're taken into Alfie's house, or you're taken into Franny's house. I just think she's fantastic. So from then on, I always ask the publisher, can we have Annie? And Annie's done all of my books, and she's done the ones that I wrote with Martina Cole as well, so she's just fantastic.
I was going to ask about that. How did that collaboration come about?
Yeah, well, it's well known now that Martina wasn't very well and she had a stroke. So, you know, Martina will always be full of stories. But obviously, after writing a book is difficult, and, you know, after a stroke, it's even more difficult. So my agent and her agent are the same. And we just decided for, you know, to continue the stories and continue the books coming out for her readers, who are really passionate, and she's passionate about continuing putting her stories out there, we decided to get together and collaborate, and it worked really well. It worked really well. It was so much fun. I'm really good friends with her now, and it was a real joy. So I did Loyalty with her, I did Guilty and No Regret, and now her next book, The Stretch, she's doing on her own because she's a fighter and she's done incredibly well to, be able to write on her own again. So yeah, I just loved writing, the books with her. It was great fun. She's a genius writer and storyteller. She really is. And, back in the day when I was going into crime, into gangland, Martina's was the books that I read just to go, okay, how do you do these gangland books? How do you write these books? Because obviously, like I said, I was new to this whole world of the idea of writing gangland. So I wanted to see how the master did it, as it were. And she's, top of her trade in it. So it was a full circle, me reading these books, long time ago, and then suddenly finding myself writing stories with her. It was incredible.
Now, we're going to get whiplashed with the change in genres here, but we're moving from crime and gangland to, well, tell us about Paddock Grove.
Ah, yes, Paddock Grove. Well, as I said, I love ponies and horses. And Walker Books approached me and they said, would you be interested in writing a book about children, ponies? You can write whatever you like, maybe set it in a school. And I thought, yeah, that's a great opportunity because when I was younger, when I read pony books, I did love them. But again, I wanted to make the pony books more inclusive. So I thought it was a fantastic opportunity. So I jumped at it. And Paddock Grove is set in a children's boarding school, a girls' boarding school. And it's all about the ups and downs of boarding school life because I went to boarding school. And it's also the ups and downs of owning a pony. So it's just a fun, whereas Birdie, there's a, sort of, it's quite deep, it's quite, looks at different themes. And whilst Paddock Grove, looks at friendship and the importance of friendship and, the importance of everyday life and maybe sometimes what that throws at you when you're in school, it was just much lighter, much more commercial and sort of fun and fast reads, maybe for the reluctant reader.
Tell us about Apache.
Oh, Apache, yes. Apache is my heart horse, and he's a 16-2 hands horse, and he used to be a horse with the person who used to ride him was paralyzed on one side. So he's a fantastic horse because he learned to understand whistles because she couldn't do the sort of the signs for him to go left or right. She couldn't use her left hand side because of her disability. So she taught him through whistles to turn left, which is amazing, and do all the things on his left hand side through whistles. And he is just such a beautiful gentleman. He looks after you, he's kind, he's got a heart of gold. When you ride him, he just wants to look after you. And when I see him, the world stops, everything goes quiet, and it really is my magic, quiet, peaceful place because, as I said, horses and ponies, they have a quality of peace, even though they're flight animals about them, and they just make you feel safe in their space. And that's what Apache does to me. When I go and see him, it's my happy place.
Now that the riding school she'd attended since she was 4 years old had been forced to close down and sell off the horses, she thought maybe, possibly, well, her dream would come true, especially now she'd won a scholarship to the Paddock Grove Equine Boarding School. Her mind suddenly flooded with thoughts of Timmy, the horse she'd bonded with, her soulmate. Could it be? Could it really be her beloved Timmy, who belonged to the local riding school and she'd been desperate to own? Don't keep us waiting. Your mum looks like she's going to burst. Her dad laughed again, and George could feel their excitement crackling in the air.
she slowly walked towards the shed. With trembling hands, she pulled the stiff, rusty bolt across. After a brief glance over her shoulder to her parents and Albert, who all nodded reassuringly, she took a deep breath and... Timmy! Timmy! George excitedly called out his name as she opened the door. Tim! But the rest of his name caught in the back of her throat, as a white face with unfamiliar dark eyes stared at her. George's mouth dropped open as she stared back. Instead of Timmy's sleek form, George saw a scruffy piebald cob with a thick mane and a messy coat covered in soaked oats. There were grass stains on his white patches, and he had long, tangled feathers that covered his hooves. Meet Bear. George's dad walked up behind her. He wrapped his arm around her shoulders. Bear? George blinked, then blinked some more, trying to stop her heart sinking. Bear? Oh, no.
That's a clip of Paddock Grove, A Pony to Own, written by J.P. Rose and narrated by Hannah Melbourne. Now, same question, were you responsible for Hannah getting the narrating job in Paddock Grove?
I absolutely was. They sent you usually four or five people to choose from. I always feel bad for the people that I haven't chosen. But Hannah was just the way she was able to capture the characters, and I could really see them. And one of my tick boxes is, like I said about when I listened to Annie, I could forget that I had written them. And so some of the narrators I've heard in the past, I think, oh, no, I can feel me still. That's my writing still. Whereas I want the narrator to take the book and put their own life into it. And with Hannah, that's exactly what happened. The minute I heard her voice, the character, or, you know, all the different characters, I just thought, you know, it has to be Hannah.
You were an actress in a past life, and I've heard you given readings online at festivals and books and things like that. Have you not fancied narrating a book yourself?
Yes, I mean, I do. It's just about opportunities. I'm thinking, I'm looking around, I'm thinking, how come this author did it? I would have loved to have narrated Birdie. Yes, I would enjoy that. But again, maybe I wouldn't enjoy the listen back because I would think, oh, why did you say it like that? Why did, you know, but just for myself, I would have enjoyed reading Birdie and recording Birdie, but I actually would prefer to listen to somebody else do it.
Now, many of your books, including the Paddock Grove and your adult crime books, are available in audio. Birdie, at the time of recording, isn't available in audio yet. It's available in Braille, but the audio version's on its way. Is it important that the book's accessible for anyone, for whatever reason, doesn't have a relationship with print?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because I actually listen, read all my books via audio. I rarely listen to, you know, read books. That's because, for me, that's because it's like a busman's holiday. When I read a book, I'm actually editing it as I read it, and I'm thinking, why did they put that sentence like that? Why did they do it like that? So I don't have the pleasure of stories that I used to before I became a writer. So I have to listen to audio. But also, some people struggle with, you know, reading, some people for whatever reason. And the idea that door is shut to them of stories, of knowledge, of wherever they want to go through these books would be cut off to them, would be a travesty. So audio, I'm such a champion of audio. It's really important. Because my mom had a dear friend who was partially sighted. And one of the things that Sheila struggled with was losing her sight because she was such a bookworm. So I used to read to her. But then when audio started to become popular and much more accessible, it opened a doorway that had been shut to her. And it really did change her life. It really did. So she could listen to everything from her, because she loved history. So, you know, history books, which was really hard going for me to read to her, or fiction. It was just wonderful. So I'm so passionate that audio should be championed for all. But yeah, they're vital, 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 vital.
One thing we'll miss if we download the book from RNIB is the cover of Birdie. Can you give us a little description of it?
I can. The cover is done by amazing illustrator Keith Robinson, and he actually sent me a painted picture of Birdie because he just enjoyed illustrating Birdie so much. And we went back and forth, trying to get the cover right because we really wanted to capture the essence of Birdie. So what the final cover is Birdie is standing with the Yorkshire landscape behind her under a grey, stormy sky, which is a mirror to how she feels. The wind's blowing, and we capture that because she's wearing a red scarf, which is blowing in the wind. She's wearing a purple woolen coat, 1950s purple wooden coat, which she got from when she was leaving the home. She's wearing white knee-high socks, but one's down because she's been running. This particular scene would be where she stopped running. And just behind her is a small brown pit pony standing there. And beyond them is a coal mine, which sits on the hill. And Birdie is standing there with a pose which says courageous, with her head held high. And you can see that Birdie's a determined girl just by the way she's standing with this landscape of the Yorkshire Dales, this purpley landscape of the Yorkshire Dales behind her.
Birdie by J.P. Rose is available in print as an ebook commercially. It's also available in Braille from RNIB, and the audio version is coming soon. And Jackie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Jackie will be back with the books of her life after this.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books, well, Roddy Doyle springs to mind, all the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me, and it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge, sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth so soft, bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books. And I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, a return to Jackie Rose, aka JP Rose, for the books of our life.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I think what made me fall in love with reading was, it sounds a cliche, but it was Anna Sewell's Black Beauty. I loved the idea that she was saying a message and sending a message to people through this horse, and it really captured the essence of what horses went through. It changed the way people looked after horses back in the day, and I felt like I went on a journey with Black Beauty, and I thought, gosh, I love that feeling. And it was really from there that I started to pick up all sorts of different books, more animal books, more Wind in the Willow, more Watership Down, Charlotte's Web, all those sort of things. But yeah, they opened a doorway to me and a window to another world. And that's what I loved about it.
The first place that I can well remember was a large, pleasant meadow with a pond of clear water in it. Some shady trees leaned over it, and rushes and water lilies grew at the deep end. Over the hedge on one side we looked into a ploughed field, and on the other we looked over a gate at our master's house, which stood by the roadside. At the top of the meadow was a plantation of fir trees, and at the bottom a running brook overhung by a steep bank. Whilst I was young, I lived upon my mother's milk, as I could not eat grass. In the daytime I ran by her side, and at night I lay down close by her. When it was hot, we used to stand by the pond in the shade of the trees, and when it was cold, we had a nice warm shed near the plantation. As soon as I was old enough to eat grass, my mother used to go out to work in the daytime, and came back in the evening. There were 6 young colts in the meadow besides me. They were older than I was. Some were nearly as large as grown-up horses. I used to run with them and had great fun. We used to gallop all together round and round the field as hard as we could go. Sometimes we had rather rough play, for they would frequently bite and kick as well as gallop. One day, when there was a good deal of kicking, my mother whinnied to me to come to her, and then she said, "I wish you to pay attention to what I am going to say to you. The colts who live here are very good colts, but they are cart horse colts, and of course they have not learned manners. You have been well bred and well born. Your father has a great name in these parts, and your grandfather won the cup 2 years at the Newmarket races. Your grandmother had the sweetest temper of any horse I ever knew, and I think you have never seen me kick or bite. I hope you will grow up gentle and good, and never learn bad ways. Do your work with a good will, lift your feet up well when you trot, and never bite or kick, even in play." I have never forgotten my mother's advice. I knew she was a wise old horse, and our master thought a great deal of her. Her name was Duchess, but he often called her Pet.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Elizabeth Proud. And is there a book on a rainy day you can happily cuddle up with and reread?
Yes, it's the To Kill a Mockingbird. I know it's sort of some deep, dark subjects, but actually, again, I love a book that can sweep you away, that you're there, that you can feel how hot it is, you can feel what they're eating, you can see it, you can feel the tension, you can feel the community around you and the characters. And that's what I find in To Kill a Mockingbird. So when it's raining outside, that is the book that will take me somewhere else every single time.
Dill left us early in September to return to Meridian. We saw him off on the 5 o'clock bus, and I was miserable without him until it occurred to me that I would be starting to school in a week. I never looked forward more to anything in my life. Hours of winter time had found me in the treehouse, looking over at the schoolyard, spying on multitudes of children through a 2-power telescope Jem had given me, learning their games, following Jem's red jacket through wriggling circles of blind man's buff, secretly sharing their misfortunes and minor victories. I longed to join them. Jim condescended to take me to school the first day, a job usually done by one's parents. But Atticus had said Jim would be delighted to show me where my room was. I think some money had changed hands in this transaction, for as we trotted around the corner past the Radley place, I heard an unfamiliar jingle in Jem's pockets. When we slowed to a walk at the edge of the schoolyard, Jem was careful to explain that during school hours I was not to bother him. I was not to approach him with requests to enact a chapter of Tarzan and the Ant-Men, to embarrass him with references to his private life, or tag along behind him at recess and noon. I was to stick with the first grade, and he would stick with the fifth. In short, I was to leave him alone. "You mean we can't play anymore?" I asked. "We'll do like we always do at home," he said, "but you'll see, school's different." It certainly was. Before the first morning was over, Miss Caroline Fisher, our teacher, hauled me up to the front of the room and patted the palm of my hand with a ruler, then made me stand in the corner until noon. Miss Caroline was no more than 21. She had bright auburn hair, pink cheeks, and wore crimson fingernail polish. She also wore high-heeled pumps and a red-and-white striped dress. She looked and smelled like a peppermint drop. She boarded across the street, one door down from us, in Miss Morty Atkinson's upstairs front room, and when Miss Morty introduced us to her, Jem was in a haze for days. Miss Caroline printed her name on the blackboard and said, "This says I am Miss Caroline Fisher. I am from North Alabama, from Winston County." The class murmured apprehensively, should she prove to harbor her share of the peculiarities indigenous to that region. When Alabama seceded from the Union on January 11, 1861, Winston County seceded from Alabama, and every child in Macomb County knew it. North Alabama was full of liquor interests, big mules, steel companies, Republicans, professors, and other persons of no background.
That classic recording from R&IB Talking Books of To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee was narrated by Marvin Kane. And is there a book that you've read recently you'd like to recommend? Doesn't have to be contemporary, but you've read it recently and it's fresh in the mind.
Yes, again, this is audio, and audio is very important that they had the right narrator. And I should have thought about who the narrator was, but she did a fantastic job. And it was My Friends by Frederick Backman. Fantastic book and fantastic narrator. Because as I say, you know, for me, the narrators are so important, as I'm sure they are for your listeners. And some books I have to stop because the narrator isn't quite right, but she captured it. Fantastic. My Friends, Frederick Backman.
Louisa is a teenager, the best kind of human. The evidence for this is very simple. Little children think teenagers are the best humans, and teenagers think teenagers are the best humans. The only people who don't think that teenagers are the best humans are adults, which is obviously because adults are the worst kind of humans. It's one of the last days before Easter. Very soon, Louisa is going to be thrown out of an art auction for vandalizing a valuable painting. Old ladies will shriek and the police will come, and it really wasn't planned. Not to brag, but Louisa did have a perfect plan. It wasn't the plan's fault that she didn't stick to it. Because sometimes Louisa is a genius, but sometimes she isn't a genius, and the problem is that the genius and the non-genius share a brain. But the plan? Perfect. The auction is one where extremely rich people go to buy ridiculously expensive art, so teenagers aren't welcome there. Especially not teenagers with backpacks full of cans of spray paint. Rich adults have seen far too much news about activists who break in and vandalize famous paintings, so for that reason, the entrance is protected by security guards weighing 300 pounds with 0 ounces of humor. They're the sort of guards who have so much muscle that they have muscles that don't even have Latin names, because back when people spoke Latin, idiots as big as this didn't even exist yet. But that shouldn't have been a problem, because the plan was for Louisa to get in without the guards even noticing she was there. The only problem with the plan was that Louisa was the person who was going to carry it out. But it started well, it has to be said, because the building where the auction is being held is an old church. We know that because all the rich people at the auction keep saying to each other, "Did you know this is an old church?" Because rich people love reminding each other about how incredibly rich they are. So rich that they can buy things from God. In a couple of days at the start of Easter, obviously no one in the room will spare a thought for God, because then God won't have anything interesting to sell to them. But the thing that's so incredible about God is that God understands people's needs, so there are always bathrooms in churches. So Louisa broke in through one of the bathroom windows, in full accordance with the plan. Her friend Fish taught her how to do that. Fish is the best at everything. For instance, the best at losing things and the best at breaking things, but she is the best of all at breaking into things. And Louisa? She's bad at pretty much everything, but good at being angry. Not to brag, but she's actually world class at that. And she's particularly angry about rich people buying art, because rich people are the worst sort of adults. And the worst way to vandalize art is actually to put a damn price tag on it. That's why rich adults hate the sort of thing that Louisa paints on the walls of buildings. Not because they love walls, but because they hate the fact that there are beautiful things that are free.
My Friends by Frederick Pakman is available for Talking Books, as read by Maren Ireland. And once again, Jackie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, every episode is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.